At 7:20, Lance, Tom, and Chris are near the front door, while Bob, Sean, and Tony are closing in on the back door. They ditch their snowshoes and ski poles and fade into the dark shadows of the house. Lance silently jogs across the dimly lit farmyard through a half-open barn door. Inside, he quickly arms and drops his small radio-controlled detonators in the gas tanks of the cars and trucks, as well as the kerosene and diesel tanks for good measure. He sets a few others on the barrels of solvents. Cat-like, he retraces his steps back to his men near the front door. They all carefully move into final positions. Bob and his guys make their way to the back porch and crouch below the back door window, from which a shaft of light from the kitchen pierces the darkness. Lance and his guys carefully tiptoe to the front porch. Lance leans over and peeks through the aged lace curtains into the living room. He sees Jack and the guys from Council Buffs huddled near the fireplace. Through the dining room window, he sees David and Todd. Go time. Lance, wearing his Bluetooth headset, whispers a message to Jay, saying that they're ready and to tell Todd. She acknowledges. Todd's phone begins vibrating, and Todd whispers to David. Here they come. David nods. Lance whispers into his mic to the guys at the back door and says, now. Both he and Bob take out two stun grenades, pull the pins, count down, then hurl them. Bob sends his through the rear window of the living room, just as Lance's crash through the front window. Lance's land on the floor a few feet from Jack. Jack and the others, startled, turn quickly towards the shattered window. They briefly see the grenades at their feet. David and Todd shut their eyes and cringe. Lance ducks back from the window and turns towards the front door, which Tom is poised to kick open. A fraction of a second later, the grenades detonate in massive crashes of blinding light and deafening concussions. Jack and the CB4, who were looking directly at them, are instantly rendered blind and deaf. Todd thrusts open the door as Bob does the same from the rear. They charge through the doors and into the living room from both ends, taking up positions all around the stunned occupants. Lance lets loose a few shots into the ceiling. Tom and Bob do the same. As Jack's vision slowly returns, he sees he's surrounded by eight guys with large guns, all trained on him and his minions. Jack drops his drink and makes a fleeting, instinctive lurch for his gun. Lance brings his assault rifle to a full aiming position and, pointing it dead at Jack's skull, says, okay, dirtbag, I ain't half unloaded this clip yet. Jack freezes, then quickly raises his hands in submission. The others also raise their hands except Nick, who charges Lance. Lance gives him a gut punch that sends him across the room where he lands in a heap. Lance's detonator clicker, however, falls to the floor near Jack's foot. Jack sees it and quickly kicks it under his chair. Tom and Bob dash across the corridor and into the dining room where they cut David and Todd's hands free. Outside, the sound of the SUVs rapidly pulling into the yard can be heard. David and Todd jog out to where Lance's SUVs have rushed the yard and now turn facing back. The large black cars sit there, engines idling, their exhaust plumes forming orange clouds in the light of the sodium vapor lamp. Mary points David to one and Todd towards another. One of the SUVs sounds its horn several times, a signal that they're ready. Lance and his men begin to retreat towards the door. Jack and the CB4 are disarmed. While the others jog to the waiting SUVs, Lance, Tom, and Bob remain in the house. Outside, Sean hurls the confiscated guns irretrievably far into the drifted fields of snow beyond. They won't be found until April. This startles three watching coyotes who scatter in the darkness. Two of the SUVs shift into gear and drive off. Tom and Bob then Lance back out. You'll do better if you sit tight, guys. I don't recommend a walk outdoors this time of year, says Lance as he walks out of the farmhouse. Outside the door, they leap into the remaining SUV where David and Mary are waiting, and Sean has taken over as driver. He guns the motor and all four wheels spin in the packed snow. He races to join the others. As the last SUV roars off, Jack and the CB4 leap to their feet and rush out to the farmyard. They hesitate a moment and watch the departing SUVs. Then Nick says, there's more guns in the van. He turns and points towards the barn. Lance reaches for his detonator clicker but realizes it's not there. He tries his other pockets. Damn, he says, has anyone seen my detonator clicker? Is it in the car? He pulls out his LED flashlight and they look quickly around the floor and seats to no avail. Oh crap, he says, now they'll be able to use their cars. I don't think they can catch us, says Sean. Anyway, we outgun and outnumber them. Well, I just didn't want any Keystone car chases through Messina, that's all, says Lance. Don't worry about it. While Jack stands waiting in the farmyard, he pulls out Lance's clicker. Seeing the label, he's curious why there's an image of what looks like a crow on it. He clicks it to see what happens, believing it controls some bomb still inside the SUVs that Lance brought but did not deploy. At Jack's command, Lance's detonators explode in multiple gasoline, diesel, and kerosene tanks where, in fact, they were deployed. The resulting blast sends burning gasoline, kerosene, and diesel fuel throughout the barn and out into the farmyard, where it soaks two of the CB4 just as they reach the door. door. The barrels of acetone and toluene rupture as they burst into brilliant flame. In seconds, the old dry bales of hay catch fire. The ancient arid wood beams above, drenched in the burning fluids, likewise quickly ignite. "Lance, I think we found your clicker," says a startled Sean, looking through the rearview mirror. "You want to go back and get it?" "Nah, never mind. Keep driving. I think they figured out how to use it. I'll get another one," laughs Lance, as he and all the other heads quickly turn to the rear. Jack freezes and looks at the barn he's just detonated. The two guys who were approaching the barn door when the blasts began are now writhing on the snow-covered ground, trying to put out their flaming clothes. Jack watches the barn burn and says plaintively, "Are there no other cars around here?" "Nope, they were all in the barn to avoid attracting the interest of the state police planes that make flyovers looking for meth labs." "We're fucked," says Jack, accurately assessing the situation. Just then, something in the corner of his eye distracts him. He turns and sees, through the window, the living room of the old house in flames. One of the upholstered chairs tipped into the fireplace as they ran out after Lance. "Oh, shit," he exclaims. "The barn's gone, and now it looks like the farmhouse is, too." He and the bewildered, shivering CB4 watch both fires and occasionally look back down the gravel road at the dim, receding shadows of Lance's darkened caravan. Then, two of the guys from Council Bluffs decide on a last desperate effort to try retrieving their coats from the burning farmhouse. The flames, however, have rapidly spread through the living room where they began and into the kitchen and beyond. Just as they enter, the entire house explodes. It seems there was a large metal container of highly unstable triacetone peroxide, a white crystalline powder used by cookers during drug raids to destroy evidence. It was, unfortunately, carelessly stored in the pantry. Two of the CB4 have no further needs of their coats. The remaining two and Jack are buffeted by the shockwave and lacerated by flying debris. In the distance, Lance's SUVs rumble on. They bounce west over the uneven but frozen gravel surface. No plume of stone dust this time. All heads but the drivers are turned east, watching the flames soar behind them. Finally, when they get to the county road, the SUVs turn left, but quickly roll to a stop at the roadside and shut their motors down. Lance, David, Todd, Mary, and the rest get out and survey the growing firestorm in the distance. The barn and farmhouse are completely engulfed, and the flames shoot high into the still night sky. Glowing embers descend slowly back to earth. Mary looks with satisfaction upon the fiery scene beyond. Casually, she plucks a cigarette from David's pocket, lights it, takes a deep drag, and pronounces in a long, smoky, sing-song voice, "O muse, the causes and the crimes relate. What goddess was provoked, and thence her hate?" "Now, isn't that much better than watching a satellite TV shopping channel, honey?" "In your dreams, dearie." "Wow, sure lights up the sky," says Sean. "Is that what a barn burning really looks like? Seems like a pretty big fire. They had a lot of chemicals in that barn, not to mention the hay and the dry timber. In the winter, it's drier here than in the desert. I wonder what Jack and the boys are doing now. No cars, no shelter. Certainly not calling the police," says Lance as he grabs an image-stabilized camcorder with telephoto lens from the rear of one of the SUVs. "I need to get some footage of this," and begins recording. The flames continue to build. "Yep, that's one hell of a marshmallow roast. The old boy must be pretty pissed, I expect," says Bob. "Not exactly the outcome he expected," adds David. Then, suddenly, a vast, brilliant, and engulfing explosion thunders across the empty landscape. A second, equally large concussion follows a fraction of a second later, then several more. A 300-yard-wide yellow and blue fireball mushrooms up into the dark and cloudless prairie sky. The shockwaves follow in a few seconds. The flaming ball can be seen for 100 miles in all directions. The surrounding countryside is lit. The farmhouse and buildings and the figures standing dumbfounded in the farmyard are all incinerated in the flash. "What the hell was that?" says Tom, covering his eyes. They all stand bathed in the brilliant light and feel the heat from the rising inferno a few miles east. "Duh, I should have known. My guess is the anhydrous ammonia tanks they had in the barn," says David. "But ammonia doesn't burn, does it?" asks Todd. "No, not normally. But if you heat it above 450 degrees, it decomposes into hydrogen and nitrogen. That barn and its gasoline, kerosene, and barrels of chemicals got a lot hotter than that," says Bob. "Right. Once the ammonia breaks down, the pressure in the tank quadruples. Then bang, no more tank. When the tank ruptures, now you've got one humongous cloud of explosive hydrogen." "Kaboom," says David. "Seem like more bangs than ammonia tanks," says Tom. "My guess is the exploding ammonia tanks caused the propane tanks to burst. That would add a few 100,000 cubic feet of explosive propane to the mix, and that makes for one hell of a fireball." I hope Jack wasn't standing too close, says David. How do you know all that, says Lance. Well, I was pre-med, you know. I did learn some chemistry, comments David, as he tosses and steps on his cigarette in the snow. Geez, now he remembers his chemistry, says Mary, her arm around his. How come back in St. Louis you couldn't tell the difference between a liter and a quart? Todd turns to David and says, I guess there's one less meth lab in Iowa tonight. David chuckles and says, you know, Todd, I think you're right. A few less drug dealers, too. They laugh and lean against the SUVs and bathe in the glow of the burning distant scene. The embers in the distance still rise far into the night sky. All at once they hear and feel the tapping of small pellets landing on them and clattering on the hoods. Lance holds out his hand open and catches one. He shines his tiny LED flashlight on it. It's a small red pill. He looks up and says with a smile, hey guys, what do you know? It's Sudafed. Over half of Adair County it's raining decongestants. The trove of so many drugstore visits by Tom and Bob is now just tiny red polka dots on the snowy white landscape. Jack, who paid for those pills, and his minions are now charred barbecue. What remains of them that the coyotes won't drag off lie in wait to surprise the morning crows, who will be happy for fresh roadkill, nicely cooked for a change. Okay, let's cut the crap, people. It's time we got back to Omaha. That fireball has, no doubt, attracted some unwanted notice. I'll bet that blast could be seen from Omaha to Des Moines, says Tom. As they speak, aircraft 7 and more miles above and for nearly 100 miles in all directions are alerting FAA en route area traffic control centers in Chicago, Minneapolis, Kansas City, and Denver to report a massive fireball somewhere west of DSM and east of OMA. National Guard helicopters from Des Moines are dispatched. They report back that it's a fire at a farm, probable propane tank explosion, and the local sheriff's office is alerted. The sheriff's office for Adair County in Greenfield has already been alerted. They, like the rest of the county, heard the concussion and saw the fireball on the horizon. From reports they received by phone, they quickly triangulate its location and concur it was probably a propane tank. Since they know the remote farm is unoccupied during the winter, the understaffed sheriff's office defers investigation until daylight. The caravan of SUVs turns onto Highway 92 and drives west back to Omaha. Chapter 16. Tuesday, January 23. Time, 9 a.m. The next day, the sheriff of Adair County drives over from Greenfield, the county seat, to investigate. Since that particular farm was known not to be occupied, there was no rush the previous night. But now he's seen the reports on TV that it was a meth lab, so what he and his deputy discovered does not surprise them. The TV was right. Just another meth lab. Good riddance to them. They let the crows have their feed and call the coroner back in town. There's no rush now. A TV crew from Des Moines, tipped off by Jay's uploads, arrives about 2 hours later and gets footage of the crows finishing off what pieces of Jack and his colleagues, the coyotes, left behind. The networks have a field day with the video of the explosions in Omaha and Adair County, Pete's demise at the hotel, and the scene of the crows picking at Jack's remains at the farm near Fontenelle. The identity of Jack's body is confirmed late in the day by the Adair County coroner, who makes a quick check of the dental records that are faxed his way by the police in St. Louis. The other four are also quickly identified. Another snowstorm races across the central plains, and soon the scene of Adair County is buried under a fluffy blanket of white flakes. Only a few timbers from Jack's farmhouse barn and the wreckage of a few cars are visible. Nothing of Jack remains. Drug kingpins in other cities, as Mike predicted, feel a considerable degree of unease as they begin to confer discreetly. They now realize they're up against a very formidable opponent. Some degree of paranoia is normal in their line of work, but each time they see a replay of the farm video, especially the sequence with the crows, their anxiety grows. They confer discreetly as to whom or what in Omaha could bring their operations to such a shambles in 15 days. There is talk of retribution, but none want to take the lead, lest they themselves become prairie crow treat. Epilogue. And in the aftermath, Mike and Jay write their expose and produce a series for cable TV, which establishes them as experts on the subject. Mike finally locates the bookkeeping entry that proves that Jack arranged for Stan's death. Mike and Jay are hired full-time as investigative reporters with an open assignment book. They continue to live at the club as they begin an investigation on international terrorist organizations. Jay develops an interest in home shopping channels. David buys Tom and Bob the equipment they need to start their landscape business, which does very well. They continue to room together at Mo Room. By day, they work on their landscaping. By night, they serve tables, tend bar, and do odd jobs. They've each been admitted to a local college and will begin night courses in the fall. They're also recruiting a band of their own. Tom starts dating Jane. Bob is seeing Lois. Mary begins her own translation of the poem. David continues to use Dryden's. The wind shifts around to the south, and the crows are displaced displaced by birds from warmer climes. The canaries continue to prosper prodigiously on the sunflower seeds. At times, Todd shuts down the sound system so the crowd below can hear the chorus of birds above. Their singing of rock anthems becomes widely known. They are particularly adept at ballads from the early 80s. On a warm early May evening, the gang are all up on the roof where there's a large deck overlooking Omaha on one side and the prairie on the other. Tom and Bob have begun landscaping it with flower boxes and decorative shrubbery. The skylights are open and many little yellow birds join them, flying about and happily nesting in the new ornamental potted trees. Mary serves drinks and they sit around and talk in anticipation of the spring night and all the stars that gild her sable throne. And as the dusky sun sinks in the west and bathes the sky in rosy beams, Mike says to David, "I always meant to ask, what does Mulroon really mean?" "Oh, I thought you knew it was my secret," answers David. "Geez, after all we've been through this past winter?" David looks around at the others, smiles, and tilts his head and flicks one eyebrow up in amusement. As the others laugh and the canaries chirp, Todd reads an incoming text message on his cell phone and frowns, but that's another story. "Friends daily flock, and scarce the kindly spring began to clothe the ground and birds to sing." Aeneidos, Publius Virgilius Maro, John Dryden, translator.